Suzanne stared at him, her eyes demanding, "Be serious. How can you make this an issue? How did we get here?" She guessed that he and Joan Lilly had never met before this evening, and now they were bonded for life in their rigid stance on Noel Coward's pathetic inferiority to the Beatles. She wanted to say something to somebody about the absurdity of the moment they were all sharing, but conversation was now over for her. These two had given taking a position a bad name. "I honestly don't know why people don't like my character," Selena was saying. "I haven't killed anyone. My husband Charles has killed 3 people on the show." "Well," Fred said, "I think the reason they don't like Dorothea, or rather, why Dorothea fascinates them, is because she's deceptive."
"Oh," said Selena, "that's very interesting. I've never thought of that. That's very intriguing."
"Let me get totally into my now," Suzanne thought. "We are in a fabulous house in Bel Air, sitting under Picassos and discussing the character of Dorothea with Dorothea over bad oyster soup." She had embraced the values of the room and found she had nothing. She promised herself to remember this sensation the next time she was invited to a party. She looked across at Joan, who seemed to be listening to a faraway concert of weird classical music, then looked at Chris. She thought he looked like an old boy, someone who should wear a backpack instead of carrying a briefcase, but a very high-style backpack. She realized with dismay that this was her type of guy. She always ended up with guys like this, in relationships she likened to being partners on a school science fair project. She always felt like calling them up afterward and saying, "You left your beaker and your petri dish here. Do you want me to bring it to class tomorrow?" Now the old boy was telling a joke. "How many surrealists does it take to screw in a light bulb?" he asked, then looked around with his eyebrows raised and his mouth open. After a moment's pause, he said, "Fish." There was another short pause and then laughter. Selena Warner said, "How clever," several times. Suzanne said, "Funny," to Gustav Bozina, who nodded with reserved enthusiasm. She considered explaining it to him and then realized the enormity of the job and thought better of it. The desserts arrived, little cakes and raspberry sauce. Everybody made noises as they chewed and swallowed and clinked their forks against the china. Suzanne ate all her raspberry sauce, then broke apart the cake to find the filling, some kind of nut paste. Suddenly there was a burst of laughter at the next table. Suzanne saw Wallace standing with Brian Whitlock, a New York director whom she now whisked over to Suzanne's happy group. Wallace was radiant. "I'm sure all of you know Brian," she said.
"Certainly," said Selena Warner, nodding enthusiastically.
The others mumbled vaguely in the affirmative, though in fact no one at the table had ever met him. "Well, I'm forcing Brian to tell this fabulous story to everyone," Wallace said. "It's just the most fabulous story." Brian looked embarrassed. "Wallace, just let me tell it, okay?" he said. He pulled over a chair and sat between Selena and Fred. "I was invited to this concert in London last week," he began. "Some benefit thing where everybody played. Bowie, Sting, Elton John, everyone. And the Prince and Princess of Wales were there. Well, I wanted to meet her so bad, I was crazy." "Afterward," he continued, "there was a reception, and I found myself standing a few feet away from her. I knew she could hear me, so I started saying all this funny stuff, and I could see that she was listening and laughing, and I thought, she gets me. She literally gets me. So I got myself introduced, and the guy who introduced us said, 'This is Brian Whitlock. He directed The Punishing Blow.' And she said, 'Really?' Well, it turned out she'd seen The Punishing Blow. So I'm in heaven, she's asking questions about my movie, and I'm making her laugh. She was very cute. And all of a sudden, I hear someone say, 'Brian!' Well, I'm talking to the Princess of Wales, so I try to ignore it, and I hear again, 'Brian!' And I look, and it's an Oriental girl in sunglasses. I have no idea who she is, but she knows my name, and she comes and stands between the princess and me and says, 'I'm Yashimoto. I work in the office across the hall from yours. How long are you in London for?' So I lean behind her and I silently say to the princess, 'I don't know who this is.' And Yashimoto says, 'I'm here doing publicity on this show and then I'm going to Lisbon tomorrow. Have you ever been to Portugal?' And the princess drifts away and Yashimoto says, 'I can't believe you're here. This is so great.' And I say, 'Do you realize who I was talking to?' She says, 'Oh, I'm just one of those people who's not impressed by anybody.' Everyone laughed uproariously, even Suzanne."
"That's actually true?" asked Chris Hunt.
"It has to be," answered Selena on Brian's behalf. "No one could make up something that absurd." But did you know the girl? Asked Joan Lilly.
She worked across the hall from me in New York, I guess, shrugged Brian, in the Brill building.
Everyone at the table seemed to be entertained, so Suzanne figured she'd take a bathroom break and kill some time. Soon she thought she could go home. Soon the bell would ring, dismissing her from party class, and she would run up the street with her hair flying behind her, free.
She excused herself to Gustave and to anyone else who felt particularly close to her, and ventured forth into the huge house. There was no one in the little waiting room, so she went into the bathroom, closed the door, and locked it. The walls were all soft, rose-colored cloth, and the sink was rose marble. Suzanne put the toilet seat down and began some real party breathing.
She heard someone enter the tiny room just outside. Two voices, two women. They seemed to be reviewing the evening.
Did you see Selena Warner, one of them said. She looks ancient.
And what about that burp of a husband she's got, said the other.
Well, you know what they say, said the first voice. TV stars can't be choosers.
Suzanne was not breathing as comfortably now. Their voices suddenly became more muffled.
Why couldn't she hear them? She put her ear against the door.
I feel sorry for her, one was saying.
Who? Thought Suzanne. Me?
She hasn't worked for a while and she lives alone, said the other.
It is me, she thought. Oh, my God, they're talking about me. How will I ever get out of here?
Why can't she get work? She's pretty good actress and she certainly has connections. Suzanne was humiliated. I can never leave this powder room, she thought. She was breathing like a sick baby.
Haven't you heard? Said one of the voices.
She's put on a lot of weight.
Everyone knows. Everyone's talking about me.
Really? Said the other.
Oh, yes. About 30 or 40 pounds.
Really? Said the other.
Oh, thought Suzanne. Who? 30 or 40? Oh.
She was devastated. Now, it hardly mattered that they hadn't been talking about her. The way she felt now, they might as well have been. She had to get home. That much was clear. She flushed the toilet and walked out into the little room. The voices belonged to two attractive women in their 40s, neither of whom Suzanne knew. She smiled and nodded at them as she passed, trying to look hopeful and thrilled. She considered leaving without saying goodnight, but ruled that out when she considered how it would look. She went back into the dining room. Suzanne waited on the edge of the party, on the outskirts of the crowd. Wallace came over.
I just can't get over Brian's story, she said. Imagine interrupting a conversation with royalty.
I was on acid when I met Princess Margaret, said Suzanne. Listen, Wallace, I gotta go. It was great, great cake.
So soon, Wallace pouted. Phil Estabrook might play one of his songs. Are you sure you can't stay?
No, really, Suzanne said, letting Wallace kiss her as she moved toward the door. I'm retaining water for a couple of people, and I've got to return it by midnight. When she put her nightgown on and went to bed, she didn't know she intended to stay there. By Sunday afternoon, though, she was fairly dug in with empty soft drink cans piling up on her night table and the slow burn of television branding her cow-like brown eyes. Suzanne wondered when she'd begun to be more of a personality than a person. When her shrink had pointed it out to her, she felt as though she'd actually known it for a long time. When she was 21, she had written in her journal, I narrate a life I'm reluctant to live.
I think that basically you're a very frightened, shy person, Norma had said, her eyebrows slightly raised with the effort of insight.
You seem very open about yourself, but it's really just part of your need to control. You want people to know that you're well aware of the truth about yourself. It's like the fat girl walking into a room and announcing that she's fat.
That's so great, said Suzanne.
You're just excited because now you have another truth to entertain people with, Norma had said. Part of your little honesty show, which exists to make people think you're not trying to stay as far away from them as you actually are.
Suzanne had been thrilled. She'd been caught.
Even as she'd been hearing these new truths, she was storing them where she stored all the pertinent information she used when describing herself to old people in a new way. Describing herself was Suzanne's way of being herself. It was as close as she got, and it was way off the mark. She had shaken her head with wonder and asked, "So now what do I do?"
She wanted to be tranquil, to be someone who took walks in the late afternoon sun, listening to the birds and crickets and feeling the whole world breathe. She just couldn't feel the life she saw she had. It was as though she had cancer of the perspective.
Suzanne lay in bed staring at the television, thinking about infinity. By Wednesday, she felt kind of dingy. She accidentally caught a glimpse of herself in the bathroom mirror and thought there was a giant shell on her neck. Is that anorexia, she wondered? Is it anorexia when you look in the mirror and your head looks like a squid without arms? She felt bloated. She'd been going to the gym for a while, and she'd really started noticing a difference in her body, but now she was getting soft and shapeless again. Casper the squid, she said aloud. Around noon, her friend Lucy called from New York, where she'd gone 2 weeks earlier to be with the married guy she'd gotten involved with. Lucy liked affairs with married men because, as she explained to Suzanne many times, you don't have to have entire relationships with them. I met him on that TV movie I did, Lucy said. Blood on the Snow, the ski resort murder thing. He played the murderer and he stalked me. It was very romantic. I mean, he played a good murderer. He didn't play a regular murderer. He played it like a charming guy. And we were on location in Idaho, and being on location is kind of a permission zone anyway. I like celebrities, I got to admit, Lucy said. And this guy is very talented. Well, actually, he's limited, but the area he's limited in is more interesting than most people's entire range. Wait, I got another call. It's him. I gotta go. Say hello to him for me, Suzanne said. But Lucy had already hung up. She switched the channel and saw a girl and a boy having sex. The girl opened her eyes and looked over the boy's shoulder just in time to see a man plunge a stake through the two of them. Suzanne looked away, scanning the horizon of her room. Her house had been driving her crazy lately. Whenever she wasn't in a relationship, her house drove her crazy. Suzanne looked at her bedside table, which contained a bag of potato chips, some weird health cookies, a box of vanilla wafers, two empty glasses, one half-full glass of two-day-old orange juice, a half-empty can of flat Diet Coke, and a jar of peanut butter. She went for the peanut butter with two fingers. The phone rang. She waited the life-indicating three rings, then answered as though she were in the middle of an enormous amount of carefree fun. Hello?
Hello, dear, said a familiar voice. This is your mother, Doris.
As opposed to my brother Doris or my uncle Doris, said Suzanne. Since we're all named Doris in this family, I suppose it is necessary to establish just which Doris this is. Otherwise, it could lead to some highly embarrassing...
How are you feeling health-wise, dear?
Her mother Doris interrupted in a concerned tone.
Because I spoke to Dr. Feldman just now, and he said you might have food allergies. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Then you could just stop eating the particular food you're allergic to and not be in bed anymore. What exactly are you eating?
Just foods that lead inevitably to bypass, Suzanne said.
Don't be smart, dear, said her mother.
Remember my food allergies? I found out I was allergic to shellfish. You could be eating something that makes you tired. Could I be eating something that makes me apathetic and insecure? Asked Suzanne doubtfully. Just imagine, here I've spent all these years in therapy and it could have been tuna all along. Suzanne was watching a black-and-white film starring Joseph Cotten and Ginger Rogers late Sunday afternoon, her ninth day in bed, when the phone rang. She grabbed it on the first ring. You're on the line, she said.
What if I were a guy, said Lucy. I would think you're desperate.
I am desperate, said Suzanne. Are you back? I thought you were spending the summer in New York with Bob. New York in the summer is like a cough, said Lucy. It's like the whole country came here and coughed. Anyway, he went back to his wife. How bad do you feel? Asked Suzanne compassionately.
Well, not too bad yet, but I always have emotional jet lag, Lucy said.
I just got home and crawled into bed so that when the impact hits me like a crippling flu, I'll be where I belong. I'm going for a world record, said Suzanne. I've been in bed for over a week. My life is like a lone, forgotten Q-tip in the second to the last drawer. Why don't you come over here and join me in my not-so-silent vigil?
I'm going to be too depressed, said Lucy. I shouldn't drive.
I'll send a limo for you, said Suzanne. An hour later, a black limousine turned off outpost into Suzanne's driveway, and Lucy got out. She was wearing her nightgown. She went into the house, through the garage, walked back to the huge bedroom, and climbed into the bed.
Actors may know how to act, she said, but a lot of them don't know how to behave.
Suzanne reached for the clicker and changed the channel. Their friend Amy Baxter was on the screen in an episode of her series, Honey, I'm Home. What do you think about this thing with Amy and the art director, she asked.
Amy will never stay in that relationship, Lucy said. She chased after him and chased after him, and now she's got him. I think she'll probably stay for a while because she'd be too embarrassed to leave so soon, but have you ever seen anyone look so bored?
Now, that isn't bored. That's Amy, said Suzanne. This guy is fabulous. He's real smart. He's good-looking. He's nice. And he's not even that too-nice thing. He's got money, he's well-connected, and he's got great taste in clothes.
It's not like she found him under a rock. This is a great guy. But you know Amy. She's holding out for a greater guy. Somebody better could move to Hollywood, and if he did, she would want that guy. Amy has to keep about 30% of herself in reserve, just in case.
Could you get me a Diet Coke? Suzanne asked in a small voice. I don't want to walk by the mirror. My hair is so greasy, it looks like it was poured over my head.
Lucy went to the kitchen and came back with two cans.
I think I'm ill-suited for relationships, said Suzanne.
And this is not a thought that's going away. I mean, I can't date my whole life. I didn't even do it well when I was the right age. Think about it. What kind of wimpy, pathetic guy would be willing to crawl through the moat of my personality and live in my house with my stuff?
She opened her Diet Coke and sipped, as if she were sucking poison out of an aluminum wound. I think I'm right on the verge of accepting that I'm going to live out my life in front of a television. She pointed at the screen.
That's going to be the last thing I see before I die, she said, starting to laugh. Rob Lowe's face in St. Elmo's fire. I'll be in a hospital, and they'll be banging on my chest to get my heart started, and I'll be staring over them at the TV screen, and this movie will be on it. It's my destiny. I feel it. I know I'm going to get old and be one of those crazy women who sit on balconies and spit on people and scream, "Get a haircut!" Lucy said.
I know this, and I don't really fear it. I just like to move toward it with as much grace and dignity as possible.
Remember what it was like when you'd be getting ready to jump rope, Suzanne asked, and two people were turning it and you were just waiting for exactly the right moment to jump in?
I feel like that all the time.
I keep thinking we'll grow out of this, said Lucy.
Grow out of it, said Suzanne. How much growing do you do all of a sudden after 30?
Well, maybe it's a hormonal thing, Lucy offered.
Maybe it is food allergies, said Suzanne. Maybe my mom's right. Maybe this is all tuna.
Could we be having a nervous breakdown, Lucy asked. A controlled nervous breakdown?
I don't know, Suzanne said doubtfully.
I'm not that nervous, and it's not really a breakdown. It's more of a back down or a backing off, a pit stop. That's what we're having, a nervous pit stop. Well, not so nervous pit stop.
I think, said Suzanne, suddenly serious, that we should agree that we won't get out of bed until we decide what to do with the second half of our lives. This is like life's intermission.
Well, but I mean, what's our plan here, said Lucy dubiously. I don't feel like we really have a plan.
Well, we could find our plan on TV, Suzanne said. That's where most people learn about morals and ideals and stuff like that anyway.
Is it really? Asked Lucy. Because I watched TV and never got any.
Maybe I did and I didn't know it.
Suzanne sighed.
We have no lives.
I think it was Freud who said that the way they determined if people were crazy was whether their insanity interfered with love and work. Those are the two areas. And we have no love and no work.
Does that mean we're crazy? Asked Lucy.
Well, certainly we're defective. We're defective units. Something broke in our head, some way we look at things broke, and now we have to fix it. Maybe there's a way to look at things that makes it okay not to have work or to wind up as maiden aunts. If there is, we should at least know about it.
I had a dream last night that I was driving in the dark without any lights on and no brakes, said Lucy.
I wonder what that means.
I don't need a shrink to figure out what it means, okay, said Lucy, who'd never been to one. I'm out of control. I know that about myself, and when I go out of control, I latch onto something that looks stable, and married men look stable to me. They look like they were etched in air, and they're there for me to make them unstable. I like to try to jar them.
Anyway, while we're on shrinks, how's Norma?
Norma wants me to lead a life instead of follow one around, Suzanne said. But she's been away for the past 2 weeks. I've been on kind of an enforced shrink break, so I thought I'd just go to bed and see what I think about all this. I don't want any advice. I mean, I like to talk to you, but I don't feel like you have any advice.
Let me just ask you one thing, Lucy said. Don't you think this is a little pathetic, to be just in bed watching television?
It's pathetic, agreed Suzanne emphatically.
I think that if you're going to be pathetic, you should be pathetic. People don't dare to be pathetic anymore.
Maybe we shouldn't tell anyone about this until we're really sure that pathetic is the way to go.
I think we should just really explore doing nothing, said Suzanne. I mean, there are a lot of people who essentially do nothing, but none who are boldly going forward and really doing nothing. We'll be pioneers in real nothing.
We're the new woman, the woman of the 80s with nothing and no one. Look at it this way. We've spent years fixing up and futzing around and being as vivacious as our nerves would allow, and it got us unemployed as actresses and as dates. So if all that effort got us nowhere, we could just as easily get nowhere without the effort. The goal should be to remove all stimuli and find out what your instincts are, if any. Because living in Hollywood, we haven't used our instincts for a long time. We've used the instincts of our environment. We've seen what other people do, and we've done the same in order to achieve their success. That night, they slept in different rooms, because both of them were used to sleeping alone in king-size beds. In the morning, Suzanne woke up 2 hours earlier than she wanted to, and lay there tossing around until Lucy leaned in the doorway and said, "Was there no air in my room, or did I just use it all up?" She walked into the room. "Are you up?" "I'm always up," said Suzanne. "That's what I am, up and in a kind of down mood." "Listen, I've been rethinking this thing," said Lucy, who was eating a piece of toast. She sat on the bed wearing a pair of Suzanne's pajamas. "I think if we stay in the house, it looks like we're admitting defeat. I think that if we're starting anew, there should be some kind of energy behind it. I mean, you've given yourself a gestation period of 9 days now. You know, like 9 months, and now it's time to break through those barricades of apathy. Let's hit the stores. We'll buy outfits for the second part of our lives." 2 hours later, they were driving into Beverly Hills in Lucy's Honda. Suzanne definitely felt better being out. While she'd been drying her hair, she'd come up with a new message for her answering machine. "I'm out, deliberately avoiding your call." And that simple burst of creativity had raised her spirits a bit. "My mood is lifting," she said, "like a small, heavy plane." She was wearing her combat shopping outfit, a blue cotton dress with slits up the side, and under it, black slacks with a blue belt. Suzanne wore only black and blue clothes. Her fashion statement was bruised. They ambled into Bottega Veneta. Suzanne loved the smell of leather, and she briefly considered buying purses of every color. She could envision some day in the future when she would have a yard sale and sell all the stuff she would never use, which was pretty much all her stuff. She watched Lucy look at the scarves. She wandered around eyeing purses, hoping no one would come up and ask her if they could help her. If they could help her, they should have shown up years ago, she thought. Lucy was very frugal. Suzanne watched her haggling with a sales girl over the price of a scarf and tried to determine what color purse she needed. She found a square black bag, very symmetrical, and as soon as she picked it up, a saleswoman who smelled of too much perfume showed up at her elbow and breathed, "Isn't that lovely?" Suzanne jumped. "Oh, yes, yes. I have a black bag, though," Suzanne added dubiously. "One can never truly have too many stylish bags of such unique design," said the saleswoman. "It is nice, isn't it?" said Suzanne. "How much is it?" "It's very, very reasonable," said the woman, taking the bag from Suzanne and opening it and looking at the card inside. She smiled, kind of a sleazy smile, like a Stepford wife. Just then, Lucy came up to Suzanne with a scarf around her shoulders. "What do you think of this?" she asked, then noticed the black purse. "Oh, are you getting that?" she asked. "Don't you already have a bag just like it?" "Yeah," said Suzanne blankly, "but what are you doing? How much is that bag?" "I don't know," Suzanne said. "It's a lot." "How much?" Lucy asked. She turned to the saleswoman. "Excuse me. I'm her agent, her shopping agent, and I intervene on some of her purchases. She's in a delirium. She's had a near-fatal illness." She took the bag out of the saleswoman's hands and opened it. $450, she said. $450, and you have a bag almost exactly like it at home. I think maybe we should save this money now, don't you, Peanut? Didn't our business manager tell us not to spend money?" "Yes," said Suzanne. Lucy took off the scarf and put it on the counter next to the black purse. "Thank you very much," she said to the woman. "I'm sorry that she had a shopping problem." They drove back to Suzanne's house, where they intended to discuss their evening plans. As it happened, neither of them had any. There was a package in front of Suzanne's door from her agent, apparently a script. Lucy squeezed her arm and said, "Today is the first day of the rest of your life." They went into the kitchen, and Suzanne got a Diet Coke out of the refrigerator while Lucy called her service for messages. "What should I do?" she said frantically when she hung up. "What should I do? Barry called. They want me to sub for somebody on the Richard Collins show. Tonight, should I do it?" "I don't know," said Suzanne. "Do you want to do it?" "If you came with me, I'd want to do it," Lucy said. "I have to admit, I've been feeling the need to be televised lately. Do you know who's on the show?" "Oh, I see. Now we're getting to it," Suzanne laughed. "No,
Who's on the show? Larry Walker. Larry Walker, the painter?
Yep, said Lucy.
It's a late night show. He gets all these weird artsy types. I've always wanted to meet Larry Walker. I love his work. Portia Lamb is one of his pieces. Did you ever see it? That one with the moonlight shining on the long, long hot dog? Come on, this is like spontaneity.
That would be a good name for a perfume, Suzanne said.
What about hair and makeup?
Well, they said they'd do all that at the studio. Come on, you don't have anything to do tonight.
All right, I'll come.
I'm afraid, Lucy said. I'm afraid I'll go out of control and talk about Bob. What if he makes me feel dumb when I reveal everything just to defend myself?
Are you sure you want to do this? Suzanne asked. Why don't you call your manager and talk to him about it?
Call Barry.
Wait a minute. Let me just be sure I'm getting this, Lucy said. Are you suggesting that I call Barry?
Go call Barry.
While Lucy called Barry, Suzanne went into the bedroom to check her machine. 3 messages.
Suzanne, this is Mark. Listen, we've got this TV movie here. I guess it's all right. And the guy has written me a note. Apparently he knows you. It's called Rehab, and it's shooting on location in town starting in late October. The implication seems to be that if the ratings are good, they'll do a sequel for the May sweeps. I just don't know how you feel about the subject matter.
Suzanne, hi, it's Sid. Listen, remember that creep Alex Daniels from the clinic, the guy who went out and OD'd about a week after I left? He called and pressured me into giving him your number. I just wanted to warn you, he's going to call, and I'm sorry if you're mad, and if you're not, call me anyway.
Suzanne, I don't know if you remember me or not. This is Alex. We were in the drug clinic together, Alex Daniels. Do you remember me? I'm calling because I got your number from, I hope you don't mind, but I got it from Sid. Anyway, remember I had told you about how I was maybe going to write a script? Well, I did, and it's getting made. I've been working on this for a year, and this is like the 3rd draft, and it's a go project. I hope you don't mind, but I used your name in the pitch. Jesus, I'm going on too long here. Sorry, I used your name, and also you told me to keep a journal, and that really helped. Anyway, I've written a character sort of loosely based on you. She's an actress. Her name is Katie. I hope you're not mad. I hope you're flattered, because that was a very big thing in my life. It had real impact. I did write it for you, and I don't know. I hope you like it. This is going to be so embarrassing if you don't remember me. I'm the guy I pushed you in the swing. Bye.
Who else is on the show? Suzanne asked as their limo headed north on Hollywood Freeway toward Burbank.
Well, there's Larry Walker and some author and somebody else. I don't know who, Lucy said.
I shouldn't be so nervous, right? I mean, this isn't the Carson show.
Suzanne pulled the Rehab script out of her bag and opened to a random page.
Here's a Katie scene, Suzanne said, flipping through the script. She's sitting on a big floral sofa and she's yelling at somebody. She's yelling at her father.
I'm afraid to tell you how I feel. Feelings are weak and weakness isn't allowed, is it?
I've seen this. This was in that anti-drug training film they kept showing us, Hooked on a Line.
You patronize me for having feelings. You're so superior to your own feelings.
He must have taken a tape recorder in with him. Is this legal?
Let's not talk about this yet, okay, Lucy said. Let's talk about Larry Walker and do I look okay? Is this lipstick too dark for television?
Oh, God, Lucy said. There's the studio. I wish you could come out with me. You could just walk out with me like I'm your dummy or something, and we'll never explain it.
Could you drop us at dressing room B up there on the left, Suzanne said to the driver.
It turned out Larry Walker was not going to be on the show. He was the canceled guest Lucy was subbing for. But by the time she got out of makeup, she was so self-absorbed, she related this news to Suzanne with no sense of irony.
I look okay, Lucy said.
You look fine, said Suzanne. You look great.
You won't lie to me, right, Lucy said. You're going to watch me and tell me how I am, and you're not going to lie.
A tall man came up to them and said, Lucy, you're on.
I'll wait for you in the green room, Suzanne said.
You better, Lucy said. You better wait for me. Suzanne walked around the corner and went into the green room. There were several other people in there, among them an attractive-looking man who looked like he was from New York. He was wearing a green corduroy jacket with patches on the elbows, a multi-plaid shirt and a tie, and jeans and hush puppies. He had brown hair and wore glasses. Suzanne thought he had an air of studiousness about him, of not stability, but something near stability. Of calm, almost. She nodded at him slightly and walked past him to another tiny couch where she watched the television monitor in the corner. Suzanne glanced briefly at the man in green corduroy. He was probably the author, she thought. He looked like he was wearing a writing uniform. She looked back at the monitor where Richard Collins was still doing his opening monologue. The probable author got up to get some coffee, then came over and sat next to her.
"Aren't you the girl who was in Seventh Tea House?" he asked. "Suzanne Vale?"
Suzanne was startled and embarrassed and said, "Yes," as if the question had been an accusation.
"That was very good," he said.
"Really?" she said.
"Well, thank you. You liked it? You liked that kind of movie?"
"Well, no, I don't really, but yes, I did," he said. "Are you on the show tonight?" "No," said Suzanne, grateful for his taking control of the conversation. "My friend Lucy is. She'll be on in a minute." "I read an interview with you once, and you were very funny," he said. "I can't remember what magazine."
"Probably an Omni," Suzanne said.
"So who are you?"
"Oh, I'm sorry," he said. "Jesse Templeman."
"The author?"
"Oh," he said, surprised. "You know my work?"
"No," said Suzanne. "I knew there was going to be an author on the show. What have you written?"
"Well, actually, I've written a novel," Jesse said. "It's called The Appetite People. I've been living in New York, but they bought my book to make a film out of it, and I'm writing the screenplay."
"Hey," he said, nodding toward the monitor. "Isn't that your friend?"
"Oh, my God," said Suzanne, realizing that Lucy had already been on for a little while. She had promised to watch and tell her how she was. "Can they put the sound on? Can someone put the sound on?"
Jesse leaned forward and turned up the volume. Richard Collins was laughing very hard. Lucy said, "I mean, I'm too old to be in the Brat Pack and too young for my own exercise tape. What am I?"
Richard Collins laughed harder.
"She's very funny," said Jesse.
"She is funny," said Suzanne. "She was very nervous."
"I'm nervous myself," he said. "I feel dumb doing this, but my publisher's, you know. Do you live out here?"
"I guess you do."
"Yes," said Suzanne.
"Well," Jesse said, "maybe we could have lunch or something, or go out sometime. What do you do to relax?"
"I don't relax," said Suzanne. "It's sort of a therapy goal of mine."
"I see.
But what I do that's the closest I get to relaxing," said Suzanne, "is I drive around and listen to loud music."
"Well, maybe we can take a long, loud drive sometime," he said.
Suzanne looked back at the screen and saw that Lucy wasn't there anymore.
"Oh, my God, I've got to go find my friend. She's going to kill me," she said. She scribbled a number on the flap of the envelope Rehab had arrived in, tore it off, and gave it to Jesse.
"This is my number," she said. "Good luck on the show."
"Thanks," said Jesse. "I'll call you sometime."
Suzanne rushed past the tall man who was coming to get Jesse and saw Lucy running down the hall toward her.
"Did you hear what I said about my father?" she asked hysterically. "He's going to kill me. He's never going to speak to me again."
"No, honey, it was fine," Suzanne said calmingly. "You were funny about the Brat Pack thing."
"Did I have lipstick on my teeth?"
"You were fine," Suzanne said. "But what did you say about your father?"
"I thought you said I was fine," Lucy said. "Were you watching the wrong channel?"
"You were fine," Suzanne assured her. "I saw everything but that. I looked away for a second."
"At what?" Lucy demanded.
"I was talking to a guy," Suzanne said, "the author guy."
"Did he think I was good-looking?" Lucy asked.
Suzanne nodded.
"And you didn't hear the father thing? Do you know what I said about my father? That he was a giant whale and I wasn't sure he was actually my father. I called him my alleged father."
"So," said Suzanne, "he's got a sense of humor, doesn't he?"
"My father? The Republican nightmare?"
"Well, are you counting on his will for anything?"
"Don't be funny about this," Lucy said.
"Oh, all right, be funny. The show is over. You can make fun of me now."
"So you didn't think it sounded slutty when I said I went on talk shows to meet guys?"
"To meet guys, no," said Suzanne. "You didn't say to blow them, did you?"
"You wouldn't know," said Lucy. "You were busy cruising the green room."
"I was not cruising.
I was talking to... You tell me to do this stuff."
"I don't tell you to do it while I'm on TV," Lucy said.
Oh, it's scheduled around your career now. My talking to guys," Suzanne said. "Let me just tell you this one thing. You look great, and I gave the guy my number. It's been a breakthrough night for both of us. Now we can go and have some French fries and donuts and really live life."
They walked out of the building and got into the limo. "What's his name?" asked Lucy, settling into her seat, and Suzanne talked about Jesse all the way back to Hollywood, thinking the whole time, "He'll never call me. And if he does, what if he's a murderer?" The dating accident. They had been living together for almost a year, though he'd kept his apartment, and she was still always a little surprised to find him there in the morning. She liked to study him when he was asleep. He seemed unarmed somehow without his glasses on, but She could only engage in this activity on weekends. During the week, Jesse got up at 7 to write. Look at him, she thought. He looks like somebody you could go up to at an airport and say, "Could you watch my bag?" Was Jesse a good man, she asked herself. He probably was, because he bored her to death sometimes. You think that if it isn't dramatic, nothing is happening, Norma had told her. The idea is to get old with them, not because of them. Pretend it's an acting assignment. Act like someone who enjoys the quiet that can be found in a mature relationship. Act normal and see if some feelings of normalcy don't eventually follow. Normal, Suzanne thought. People don't get much more normal than us. We're prototypes for the new normal line of people who were designed to pave the way for the 90s. She realized that she and Jesse were getting serious. Serious. She hated the sound of it. I joked myself into a serious situation, she told Lucy. Then Lucy met Lowell Stevenson. When No Survivors came out, she received a lot of attention, so that when she went to Seattle over Christmas to make up with her father for the things she'd said about him on the talk show, Lowell, the head of New Age Studios, recognized her on the plane and struck up a conversation. She was seeing him fairly regularly now. Sometimes the four of them would go out together. Lowell even cooked for them once. This is exactly how I like it, Lucy had whispered Suzanne while Lowell was perfecting the salad dressing. Bread maker and breadwinner all in one. How did we ever end up as parts of couples? Suzanne asked as they watched Lowell show Jesse how to sauté shrimp. Think of it as an experiment, Lucy suggested. After their fifth date, he hadn't called her for 6 days. Suzanne was stunned. She forgot what he looked like. Smoke in a room, that's what he is, she told Lucy. I've been in a dating accident. A terrible, terrible dating accident. Then he called. Again she was stunned. I didn't think I'd hear from you again, she told him. Why, he asked. I told you I was going to New York and that I'd be back on Monday, today. They had survived the dating accident together, and on their sixth date, they had total, endless nightmare sex. Big kabuki sex, Suzanne called it. Do you want to stay over? She asked, her chest tight. I really should go. I'm writing in the morning, but I... Okay, she interjected quickly. Okay, she said again, this time quieter. I'd love to, though, he said, nuzzling her affectionately. You're so calm, so still. I'm like a peaceful flesh rock, she said moodily. He turned her toward him and put her head on his shoulder. What's the matter? Nothing. Which nothing? He asked. Suzanne said quietly, you're leaving me. I'm not leaving you, he said. I'm leaving to write. I have to. It's okay, she sighed. I'll get over it. Do you have an alarm clock? Jesse asked wearily. She had had relationships before. Well, people had had relationships with her. Eventually, she would always end up on drugs, and there were only two roles you could play with someone doing drugs. You could either do them too, or you could object to doing them, or both. In any case, the relationship then became in part about drugs, and then it was just a matter of time until the drug part wore away whatever it had been about before. She explained to him that she hated the L word, that she always felt like she was under some kind of obligation when she heard it. Why do you tell him these things? Norma had asked. One day you might want him to say this terrible phrase. To Suzanne's surprise, that day came. She began watching his mouth, imagining what it would be like if he ever said the sentimental trio. One night when they were kissing, he looked into her eyes, his expression almost sad. After the briefest moment, she hadn't even realized they were gazing at each other through pounds of air. He cleared his throat and looked away shyly. I wasn't going to say I love you, I swear, he said. I know it looked like it, but I wasn't. She refused to let the sleeping giant win. This was a nice guy. He didn't deserve the horror that hid inside her. She held on, and after a while, those feelings began appearing less and less frequently, like reverse labor. She wanted to walk up to couples in the street and find out what their relationships were, as if that would somehow help her determine how hers was going. One Thursday, she spent the entire afternoon in the Bodhi Tree bookstore. She discovered two things. You should communicate openly with your partner, and red meat is bad for everything, including relationships. He was suspiciously nice. He had to be hiding something. You leave him alone, warned Norma. He's fine. You're the weird one. You're looking for something to fix. Watch out you don't fix it till it breaks. You're having a normal relationship, Norma said firmly. You don't feel normally about it, but that's another step.
I don't wonder if he's a murderer anymore, Suzanne said.
Very good, said Norma.
I think he's a narc.
She postponed reading Jesse's novel for the longest time until Lucy finally volunteered to read it first and sort of test the waters. When she finished it, she was quite enthusiastic. It's real good. Go ahead and like him, she told Suzanne. It's about a bunch of obsessives, one of your favorite subjects. So Suzanne read it and was relieved to find that she thought it was very good. Even the sleeping giant seemed to like it, except for a couple of the sex parts. Sometimes she disliked the sight of his feet, or the glint off his glasses when the light hit them at a particular angle, or the sensation of hearing him use a word that she didn't know the meaning of. But then she'd smell his soft Jesse smell, or he'd read something to her about some South African riot, or she'd watch him bent over his typewriter making a correction, and she'd think, he's mine. I own him. Or, in a healthier vein, she'd feel a sense of belonging, a corny feeling that embarrassed and thrilled her. She felt like a what's wrong with this picture element in a Norman Rockwell painting. She wasn't exactly sure when he'd started calling her Gail, but it was pretty soon after he'd moved in. She called him lots of things, ranging from Joseph to Sir. It was their understanding that she called him so many names because he was so many things to her. One morning, while driving to the gym, she suddenly panicked. I'm going to die, she thought. I'm going to be killed in a car crash. Her hands gripped the wheel and she slowed to the speed limit. Suzanne was convinced that now that something nice and regular was happening to her, she was going to die. Whereas she used to hasten her death through substance abuse, she now feared for her life because she had reason to live it. She had felt the hot breath of irony at the back of her neck for years. Now she was breathing irony, filling her lungs with invisible irony, its buoyant dread charging the atmosphere, moving in like a cold front. You're suffocating me, she whispered lovingly to Jesse as he lay sleeping. On the way to the bathroom, she had an idea. She'd make him some waffles. Waffles and muffins and bacon and, well, that was probably enough. Oh, and orange juice and coffee. Coffee with cinnamon in it. Maybe she shouldn't make waffles, though. Her slapstick tendencies had a habit of rearing their ugly heads during waffle preparation. Still, she wanted to do something nice for him. She'd been staring at him for half an hour. Now she'd sort of woken him up. All in all, she felt she owed him waffles. That big waffle gesture was the only one that would do. She smiled at her reflection, filled with the enthusiasm of bold resolve. 20 minutes later, on the way to the hospital, Jesse said, But why waffles? I don't even really like waffles. Look, said Suzanne stoically, it's already starting to blister. She held up her left hand with its domestic scar across the knuckles where the waffle iron had landed.
He shook his head in bewilderment and patted Suzanne's head. Isn't this the emergency room where they know you?
Yes, she said, smiling slightly. I should open a house account here.
They should at least give you a quantity discount, he said, heading south onto La Cienega.
What was the last thing, the dog bite?
The dog bite, she said cheerfully. Unless you count the time I had to take Lucy to have her IUD removed.
She held out her hand to him.
It hurts, she said with some surprise.
You're a brave girl, he said.
Soul, she corrected him. I'm a brave soul.
She sighed. This is what I get for trying to be the cooking half of a couple.
Gail, don't be dramatic, Jesse said. You've made meatloaf and spaghetti several times without incident.
She was quiet for a few moments, then asked meekly, Don't you have your dude fest tonight?
You mean am I leaving you alone with your hand tonight, he said.
No, Gail, I'm staying with you.
Oh, goody, said Suzanne maturely.
Epilogue. Dear Dr. Blau, of course I remember you. Who else would have sent me a stuffed animal exactly like the one he gave me after he pumped my stomach only 20 times the size? When you gave me the little one 3 years ago in the hospital, I thought it was a thumb of some kind. Now, though, in its enormous form, I see that, of course, it's a dolphin. How great. No one's ever given me a giant pink dolphin before. How did you know I've always wanted one? You must think I'm very inconsiderate for not acknowledging your first letter sooner, but I've just moved to a new house. I'm rehearsing a play, my grandfather died, and I'm inconsiderate.
I hardly know where to begin in response to your question about what have I been up to for the past 2.5 years. Suffice to say that the last time I did dope was the last time I saw you, and nothing personal, but I don't want to see you or anyone else standing next to me with a hose ever again, unless we're standing over flowers in a backyard. Sometimes I feel like my life ended and I'm still here. Other times I feel so calm, I swear I can hear air moving slowly over the earth. I still eat junk, I don't exercise enough, and last week I had a cigarette. But I figure if I had to give up everything I put between me and my feelings, I'd stand at the center of my being and howl like a lonely old dog. Unfortunately, I'm not available for dating, as you so quaintly inquired. I'm presently living with someone and have been for over a year. I guess I like it. One of the hardest habits for me to break is taking the right things the wrong way. If I was available, though, I would definitely consider you as an escort, since even after I'd thrown up on you, you said you found me interesting. For that, I am truly grateful. I had what I call my triumphant return to the Cedars-Sinai emergency room a while back for a burn, but I didn't see you there. Your psychodrama group sounds intriguing, but I think I'll stick to conventional therapy for now. I still don't think I feel the way I perceive other people to feel. I don't know if the problem lies in my perception or my comfort. Either way, I come out fighting, wrestling with my nature, as it were. And golly, what a mother of a nature it is. Sometimes, though, I'll be driving, listening to loud music with the day spreading out all over, and I'll feel something so big and great, a feeling as loud as the music. It's as though my skin is the only thing that keeps me from going everywhere all at once. If all this doesn't tell you exactly what I'm doing, it should tell you how I'm feeling when I'm doing whatever it is. Thanks again for the dolphin and your letter. I hope this finds you well and still on the right side of that hose. I have to sign off or I'll be late for my shrink. I'm expecting a breakthrough any decade now. Happy New Year, Suzanne.
Copyright Phoenix Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.